Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more.
Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and this is our third program devoted to the subject of Ornette Coleman, the Texan. And going to read from a book, a really wonderful book that everybody should read who loves jazz, called Four Lives in the Bebop Business by A.B. Spellman. And it offers portraits of four musicians, Cecil Taylor, Jackie McLean, Herbie Nichols, and Ornette Coleman. And I read this book a long time ago, and it must have planted seeds in my mind. I want to take a look when this first came out. 66, yeah, so I definitely was reading it in the 70s. And, well, you'll see. There's a whole lot of information about Ornette's Texas roots in this book. And so this is part three of our series on this subject. And the question might be, why are we making such a big deal of this? And it's because I think Ornette's career and music and art illustrates a very important point about jazz, which is that as sophisticated as it gets, and it does get very sophisticated, this music is rooted in America, you know, not necessarily New Orleans, Chicago, New York. Much as I love those three places and think they're great music centers, the music came from all over America and from every city, every town, every state. And that sometimes gets missed in the history of jazz. And given that Ornette had such a massive international reputation and was considered, an extremely sophisticated musician, I think it's important to realize that he came from, well, I won't call them humble roots, the fertile roots of the musical tradition in America. So let's talk a little bit about the book. I'm just going to read selections from the chapter on Ornette. By the way, it's a great book. Everybody should get it. Here we go, from page 84. Ornette recalls hearing music everywhere. Quote, I used to go around the neighborhood and hear guys playing kazoos and various kinds of odd instruments, combs, for example, making up all kinds of music. But I didn't really get into any kind of music myself until my first year in high school. He had to live with seeing all his friends joining a church band and taking up instruments. Although he begged his mother for a horn, she was too broke to afford it. Ornette persisted, and his mother, indulgent of her only surviving son, finally told him if he got a job and started bringing some money home, she would see what she could do about a saxophone. He did, and she did. One night she woke me up and told me to look under the bed, and there was an alto saxophone. I had never touched a horn before. He was about 14, but even earlier, Ornette had been fingering a horn. I'm not sure what that last bit says. On the one hand, he says he never touched a horn before, and then Spellman says he'd been fingering a horn. So I'm not sure exactly what that means. Really interesting here is the reference to the kazoos and the various kinds of odd instruments. And we had a great interview on the upbringing of Louis Armstrong. And you can look that up. Let me see if I can find it. We do everything live here with some preparation, but not total preparation. So I want to find this article and shout it out to you because it's a very important one, also for understanding the history of American music. Vic Hobson. And Vic Hobson wrote a book called Creating the Jazz Solo. And in it he goes into great detail on what the musical life of young Louis Armstrong was like. And it was dominated by homemade instruments. And this is something we never talk about, we never really hear anyone mention. We see the final product on the vinyl or on the CD or on the streaming service or on the festival stage, but we don't know much about where things begin. I think it's very important to know where things begin if we want to encourage the art to flourish and more young people to get involved in it. So his cousin, continuing, who had been giving saxophone lessons, would often leave his instrument around the house and Ornette would pick it up and experiment until he was able to play by ear saxophone solos from whatever records there were on hand at the moment. Quote, I had a pretty good ear because about a year later I was making jobs. If some rhythm and blues tune would come out, I would learn it on the horn and go right out and play it in a nightclub in a dance band. And Ornette's cousin, of course, was James Jordan. And then there's a fascinating story here. Really illustrates a lot about his musical upbringing. At about 3 o'clock one morning, a tenor player, Weldon schoolboy Haggerty, came to Ornette's house, woke the family, and asked if he could borrow Ornette's horn. Schoolboy was working in one of the many gut bucket honky-tonks one finds in a southern city the size of Fort Worth. He needed a horn to make his gig, and Ornette, who had always heard that Haggerty was one of the leading local musicians, was anxious to hear him play. Ornette's mother was, of course, reluctant to let her son's horn go, but he told her that Haggerty would pay him a $10 rental fee for it, which was untrue. Remember, Ornette's 14, right? When his mother worried that the horn, which was worth a lot more than $10, might get lost, Ornette convinced her that he should go along with the horn and pick it up when Haggerty had finished playing. She was highly doubtful about letting her teenage son go to such a place of ill repute, but again, the will of the house's only surviving male prevailed. Soon after, Ornette Coleman, still in high school, was making gigs of his own. It's a pretty tolerant mom. And I want to read something here from Charlie Moffett. He remembers that while his and Moffett's mothers were constant, oh, this is from Prince Lachey, a flautist from Fort Worth. He remembers that while his and Moffett's mothers were constantly complaining about the teenage musicians, quote, raising so much hell in the living room, unquote, it was Ornette's house that was best known among the teenage jammers as a place to practice without interference from the family. So we really got to thank Mama Coleman for a lot. You know, someone's got to provide the basis for people to learn, right? You know, this stuff is not, it does not get downloaded from divine sources. I mean, to an extent, maybe it does, but people have to have a chance to play and make noise. By the way, Ornette's father, who he didn't remember much about, had one photograph of him in a baseball uniform. Got to be great if some scholar could dig the answer up to this, and that he was a singer, and that he actually used to sing around Fort Worth And that was his mother's, Ornette's mother's recollection, not Ornette's, because he died when he was, when Ornette was seven. All right. There were in the school band some musicians who, like Ornette, were playing rhythm and blues and jazz on their instruments outside of school. King Curtis was one. King Curtis, how do you like that? Curtis and Coleman played both jazz and rhythm and blues, tenor, saxophone then, but neither made a distinction between the two styles at the time. Prince Lachey played saxophone. He and Ornette were called jazz hounds and were finally dismissed from the band, the high school band, for jazzing the Washington Post march. Ornette was deeply offended, as though as he had been completely innocent on that particular occasion, though he laughingly admits he had jazzed other tunes before without the director catching him. Okay, now into some depth about what the environment was like. All these teenagers worked the Fort Worth black night spots, but you would not have recognized them at the time. Ornette now dresses relatively conservatively, notwithstanding a taste for odd hats. But the style of the Black South in the mid-40s was dominated by the Cab Calloway Billy Eckstein image. The Dizzy Gillespie look was only for magazine consumption. And even though Ornette and his friends did hear Gillespie, they never wore the berets and leopard skin jackets that adorned him on the ebony covers. Cab Calloway's zoot suit was a reality in the South, as was Billy Eckstein's famous wing-shaped Mr. B collar. Zoot was the unborn calf and knob shoe, the fuzzy beaver hat, the neat seat with the repleat pants, pegged down 7 inches. Ornette Coleman's jacket had thickly padded shoulders and patch pockets with flaps. His hair was conked, the curl glue out of it with a gelatinous substance called conchyline, and combined backward flat down of his head and combed backward flat down on his head until it formed a thick, shiny surface. That was Ornette then, smaller than his suit, long pointed lapels, shoes either needle pointed, unborn calf, or long, slim, square upturned toe knobs or rockers. So these guys were making some money and they were styling some fancy clothes. On the bandstand in those days, Ornette's playing was out of the Lynn Hope or Big J. McNeely bag. He, quote, went crazy, unquote, when he played, doubled over backwards with the bell of his horn, pointed over his shoulder, jumped up on tables, and danced while honking the latest Ornette Cobb solo. Ornette, the teenage honker and contortionist of the saxophone, acquired a gut bucket essence in his music then, which he has never lost. I would say that it's pretty clear that the music of Ornette Coleman has deep roots in Texas. The arrangements were all copies, mostly by ear, of the rhythm and blues groups, which were popular at the time. In the honky-tonk and after-hour joints, where he worked most often, this was all that was in demand. There was no separation of gut bucket music from any other kind. Among the instrumentalists Ornette used to copy were Big J. McNeely, Louis Jordan, Ornette Cobb, and Gene Ammons. Prince Lachey was the singer and alto saxophonist of the group. Moffat was the trumpet player, interestingly enough, and Ornette was the tenor saxophonist. The others came from a rotating list of approximately a dozen musicians of all ages. When Lachey sang, he sounded like Louis Jordan on the Louis Jordan arrangements. Southport, West Virginia, and I'm going to move my way out to the outskirts of town. And Billy Eckstein on the Eckstein copies, Prisoner of Love and Sweet Georgia Brown. Moffat remembers that Arnett later came to imitate Charlie Parker and Alan Eager, but that it was Louis Jordan and Billy Eckstein who were most in demand. Ornette's sister, Travenza, also known as Trudy Coleman, and by the way, you can find her singing on YouTube, not much, unfortunately, but it's there, fulfilled the functions of an agent representing the group and helping to work out a repertoire. All of the musicians from Fort Worth, and here we go, here's something that Dave Oliphant and I were hinting at in our interview, and I think it's important to form a picture of the scene. All of the musicians from Fort Worth agree that it was a hustler's town. There was oil money, cattle money, and textile money, and some of it filtered down to even the lowest classes. It attracted musicians, and of all the major bands, and all of the major bands came through Fort Worth. Ornette even sat in with Stan Kenton's orchestra once. Nightclubs of all descriptions flourished, and the shadiest ones hired teenage musicians of dubious professional standing. And it's amazing how important these dubious, these shady nightclubs have been to the history of the music. Why? Because they gave young people a chance to play, and that's what they need. And other less shady places maybe wanted a different kind of musician. So what do we do? You know, how do we make up for that? You know, young musicians need lots and lots of opportunities to play. During his high school years then, Ornette Coleman spent half his day in school and half his night working in some of the most disreputable night spots in Fort Worth. If his mother disapproved of her son working in places where people were regularly cut and shot to death, and where weekend riots were the norm, what could she do? Ornette usually earned more than $100 a week, an incredible wage during the 40s. I think you could rent an apartment in Manhattan in those days for less. But anyway, an incredible wage during the 40s, and as Lachey says, more than any of his high school teachers made. So he's going, now this is quoting Ornette directly. Like most of the places we worked in, it was mainly a gambling joint. Oh, no, let me go back a little bit, excuse me. So Ornette says, quote, I've seen guys get cut up and shot and killed. Pretty rough stuff for anyone to see, let alone a child, right? 14 years old, you're a child. Quote, like most of the places we worked in, it was mainly a gambling joint. The music was a cover for gambling. When the Texas Rangers would come in, people would run out and start dancing so they couldn't legally take you out and bust you. That night was very rough even for that place. A couple of guys got cut up and one was shot and killed. Now, he was about to go to the prom that night and he got the call for the gig and they needed the money, so he had to go. So he's sitting there in his prom tuxedo. You know, you don't think of Ornette Coleman as going to the prom or wanting to go to the prom, but he clearly did. So I was sitting up in this place in my tuxedo, crying my heart out, thinking that the music I was playing was causing these people to cut each other up. I always wanted to get out of there, but I was making maybe $100. Coming from a very poor family living by the railroad track, well, you can figure that one out. Anyway, I was more or less supporting my mother and sister and doing what I thought was right. Okay, so that's how it worked. So let's talk about a big influencer on Ornette, a guy named Red Connors. Red Connors is a tenor and alto saxophonist who Ornette insists was doing in the mid-40s much of what John Coltrane is doing in the 60s, but in a gut bucket style. After Coleman's own group disbanded, he came to work several times in a large group led by Connors, who must have seen some talent in the young tenor man. It was Connors who taught Ornette the value of learning to read music even though most of the arrangements the band used were head arrangements, which means head, literally, you got to remember them. Now I'm going to read what Ornette says. He always has something interesting to say. The notes that made up the musical passages were the most important thing to him, what notes and what order they were played in. I found this to be a very important asset to me in learning to play music, because with many things, if you don't have it in your head, you might not be able to repeat it. So if you have the notes in your head and you know how to phrase those notes, you can get the passages that you played before. I never saw Red or those others writing music down, that is, writing compositions, but they did have musical knowledge of what they were doing. It was Connors who introduced Ornette Coleman to the phenomenon of bebop and thus taught him the difference between popular jazz and serious jazz. Ornette had until then been entirely under the influence of local musicians and the big-name R&B artists. Although he was to continue working primarily as a rhythm and blues musician during the remainder of his professional period in Texas, he did get to play bop arrangements in Connors' band whenever circumstances would allow. Now, here's something really important and just helps you visualize again. So, remember, Ornette's a teenager, right? He's not even close to 18. Ornette says, quote, I heard them play every bebop tune that was recorded between 1943 and 1950. They could play any other composition by any other major guys who were writing bebop music. I knew most of the tunes. I could play those that Bud Powell and Charlie Parker had written and George Shearing had written. Anything that was melodically complicated, I thought I had to learn a bunch of bebop tunes. So there's a lot more here. We're just touching the surface. And I'm going to talk about that Amarillo gig that we referred to in program number two. Ornette, quote, realized around then that I would have to leave Fort Worth and Texas altogether. But I had never spent any time away from home. And I couldn't really think of what it would be like to leave Texas or how to go about it. So he spent the next year gigging in Fort Worth, listening, quote, to guys like Roy Brown, Charles Brown, Lonnie Johnson, and Gate Mouth Moore. Joe Turner came to Fort Worth and stayed about 2 or 3 months, and I backed him with my band for a couple of months there. That's the only kind of music I would play in public for singers who were singing the blues. And boy, how important is that to understand that about Ornette's roots? I'm just going to read that again. So during these teenage years, he had his own band, and he was good enough to back Joe Turner when he came to Fort Worth. And that's the only kind of music I would play in public for singers who were playing the blues. Actually, Ornette's first gig out of Fort Worth had come a few years earlier in Amarillo, Texas. A Negro club owner from Amarillo named Carter came to Fort Worth and heard Ornette in one of those after-hours clubs where he was gaining a reputation as a hard-blowing saxophonist. He decided that Ornette was the perfect complement for his house band in Amarillo and that he would have him at any cost. So Ornette was something of a star, right? A phenom in that scene. That particular band was led first by guitarist Rudy Green, who left for New York after a few engagements, and then by Moffitt, Charles Moffitt, who had become a proficient reader and writer of music in a Navy music school. Ornette had sent for his cousin James Jordan, a baritone player, and Red Connors came in from Wichita Falls to play tenor. Moffitt remembers that Ornette began to develop about this time as a writer and composed a tune named the, quote, Berry Cup Shuffle after Berry Cup Wine, 15%. And Moffitt still enjoys playing that piece. I'd love to hear that. By 1949, 19-year-old Ornette Coleman had come to some kind of impasse. in Fort Worth, which he did not understand. Bebop and rhythm and blues seemed intransigent musics to him now, although he recognized them as head and feet of the same body. The problem was that he had no outlet for playing and developing his music, but of course it was not as simple as all that to him at the time. Quote, I hadn't seen much else. All I knew was that all kinds of things weren't right with me at Fort Worth. His departure from Fort Worth was based more on this growing sense of discontent than a clear decision to make a break. And the most common means for young musicians anxious to leave their hometowns and get into the mainstream of jazz has always been to hook up with a touring band, and that was what Arnett did. His choice was a mistake, and a long, drawn-out trauma for the teenager who was still tied tightly to his mother's apron strings. Arnett had played with several of the bands that had stopped over in Fort Worth, and he was an energetic, sincere, and obviously talented young musician. But, as Charlie Moffett said, quote, Arnett was sounding like Arnett by the time he was 17, unquote, for he had an eccentric, strangely tuned style of playing, whether in rhythm and blues or bebop. It's hardly surprising that none of the traveling band leaders of the time proposed to take him on the road with them. Had he been a more glib musician, Arnett might have found a seat in somebody's reed section, and such a seat might have exposed him to the kind of first-rate musicianship that would have saved him years of isolation. As it was, the only opening he found exposed him to the meanest employment conditions that existed in the entertainment business. Arnett went to work for, quote, Silas Green from New Orleans, unquote. I don't want to question Mr. Spellman on this point, but even though it was called a minstrel show, I think it was more of a vaudeville kind of show, and the minstrel name was just a hangover, but I could be wrong on that too. The history of minstrelsy as a force in American culture has been well documented, and documented, and here it is necessary to reflect on only a few aspects of it. Musically, minstrel shows had disseminated a good deal of Afro-American music from city to backwoods, from state to state. Whatever homogeneity developed in certain of its forms, notably blues, was largely attributable to the minstrel show tradition, we'll call it. All right, so this is really important. So these traveling shows, which Dave and I talked about, were a big deal. Remember, you know, there was no television. There was radio, but it wasn't all that great. Movies were around, but they definitely were not movie theaters in small rural towns. So these traveling shows did a lot to spread the music around the country. And whatever homogeneity developed in certain of its forms, notably the blues, was largely attributable to this minstrel show tradition. The blues was spread by singers such as Gertrude Ma Rainey, who appeared in Rainey's Rabbit Foot Minstrels. It was Ma Rainey who discovered Bessie Smith and started her on her career. Instrumental jazz, as it was being played in New Orleans, was heard in many backwoods areas for the first time when minstrel shows based in and passing through New Orleans, picked up musicians. So this is really, really, you know, we talk about the music coming from everywhere. The music got everywhere, even into the backwoods. And it got there by virtue of these touring groups. And New Orleans, clearly, very important force, right? That was a huge concentration of great musicians. And that's where you would go to pick up guys to take on the road. So this is, I think this is an important vision. The music was everywhere. Wasn't just in a few places, just wasn't just in a few cities, wasn't just in the cities. It got everywhere as a result of the touring groups. Jelly Roll Morton, who worked with McCabe and Young Minstrels in 1910, was one such musician, one of the New Orleanians that traveled, as was Bunk Johnson, who played with Holcamp's Georgia Smart Set from 1903 to 1931. So that's a long period of time, and 1903 is way before recorded jazz. By the turn of the century, two kinds of minstrel shows played the South. One was the highly paid variety represented by Mahara's Minstrels, featuring W.C. Handy, by no means a blues musician, which played its own version of, quote, high-class music, and it would have nothing to do with the blues. The other played barrel house music, as the Silas Green Company advertised in the Freeman of March 1914. Quote, they play the blues, and that's all. So we had a little bit of a distinction and rivalry there between high-class music and the blues. It was groups such as Silas Green and the Johnson & Johnson's Minstrels that outlived by far the sophisticated black minstrels. Both had largely disappeared by black minstrels and blackface white groups. So both had largely disappeared by 1920. So the high class shows faded away, and what was left were these barrel house shows. And luckily, A.B. Spellman actually attended a Silas Green show, so he can tell us exactly what it was like. He goes on, as an adolescent in Elizabeth, North Carolina, I recall crawling under the canvas tents of, quote, Silas Green from New Orleans to watch the semi-naked women do their dances and hear the comedians' crude, but I thought then, hilariously funny jokes. This was about the same time that Ornette Coleman joined one of the Silas Green troops. So there were many of them traveling simultaneously. But he never came as far as North Carolina. By 1950, the company was seedy. Its canvas tent was ragged. Its dancers somewhat shopworn. Elizabeth City was a small enough town, approximately 13,000 population, but the Negroes who lived in it seldom attended Silas Green shows. The group drew its biggest revenue from the, quote, country people who lined the city streets on weekends. We had radio, and most of the country people did not. This is A.B. Spellman. So here we are, 1950, not that long ago. And if you lived in the countryside in those days, you likely did not have a radio. So you can see how important these traveling shows were. We had a radio, and most of the country people did not. We also had a movie house, as I referred to earlier. You didn't have a movie house out in the countryside. Fights were frequent. Gambling always took place behind the tents. And if a Silas Green group hit town during the summer potato season when the migrant workers were in Elizabeth City, the entire area would be off limits to us city kids. It's not difficult to understand then why Ornette had to con his mother into letting him take the job with Silas Green. When he told her, what he told her was he had a job with, quote, with a guy who wanted to organize a band to go to Dallas, unquote. If she had known the real itinerary, she never would have permitted him to go. In the old days, it was known as the TOBA circuit, named after the Theater Owners and Bookers Association. But the blues people thought it stood for tough on black artists. Ornette said, quote, we went to Oklahoma, Georgia, New Orleans, Mississippi, and Little Rock. We played in all Negro theaters and in outdoor tents. The music was strictly minstrel music, since we used to play for shake dancers and all that kind of stuff. Most of the guys were from the sort of places we were going to, from Alabama and Mississippi. I was the only guy from Texas. I went to some places, man, and saw some scenes that I hate to even talk about. I thought I had played in some rough places in Fort Worth, those gambling joints and all that. But the scenes we had in that minstrel group were something else. It was the worst job I ever had. I was miserable. And it's kind of hard to imagine something worse than a place where people are getting stabbed and shot. I mean, wow. So that tour was even worse. And while he was on the road, somebody from a company called Imperial Records wanted to record Ornette and did. The guy picked up some musicians and we went to the studio where I recorded some tunes right off the top of my head. I don't know what happened to them. I'd like to run them down sometime. So would I. That would be pretty amazing. So that's where I got fired from the carnival band in Natchez, Mississippi. Ornette then joined Clarence Samuel's rhythm and blues group and toured the South with him for a few months until late 49, when he got stranded in New Orleans. And that's a kind of a legendary story, but I'll read a little bit of it. In Baton Rouge, the week before, the band had been playing in a roughhouse dance hall. During one of the dances, Ornette decided he would make one of those intermittent interjections of his own idea of modern music into the middle of his blues solo. All that he accomplished was stopping the dance and touching the nerves of some of the toughest men in the hall who beat him up afterwards and ruined his horn. And that was when, reading on, we've talked about this before, but it's an important part of jazz history, and everybody should know it. Ornette's friend in New Orleans was clarinetist Melvin Lassiter. Now, I thought Melvin played trumpet. I could be wrong. And he was lucky to have him after the Baton Rouge incident. He looked up Lassiter, told him his trouble, and Lassiter immediately offered him a room in his mother's house. And there again, we have the absolutely essential role that women have played in the development of jazz. And I'm not being trivial about this. You know, somebody's got to provide the physical base for the thing to happen. And it's women, you know, it's women. Melvin's brother had recently stopped playing alto and, quote, "That's how I started back playing alto. It was while I was staying at Melvin's that I started playing like I'm trying to play now. The things that me and Don Cherry were doing, Melvin and I could do that then." And that was 1949. And I have an actual interview that I did with Ornette where he goes into this in greater depth. Not only was he playing some gigs here and there, not many though, but he was playing at church. And I have their interview. It's on our site. I might be the only one that has it. And he says that it was in the New Orleans church, in the sanctified church, that he felt for the first time he was able to play. I mean, he had the music in his head, and he was certainly playing it privately. But it was the first time he was able to play the way he wanted to play in public. So that important breakthrough for him personally as an artist and for the entire music took place in a New Orleans church. It's important. It's important to know these things, right? All right, I'm going to skip ahead now. Ornette ended up in Los Angeles, where he met Don Cherry and reconnected with Charles Moffett. Also, Charlie Hayden. That band got discovered, and they ended up in New York City. And in 1959, which maybe it's fitting that we're paying a lot of attention to Ornette right now, because we're coming up on a big anniversary, the 60th anniversary of Ornette's gigs at the Five Spot. And I think anybody that knows a little bit about jazz history knows how important those gigs were. So he played. He was this phenomenon. Turned jazz upside down. Didn't really like the way things were going commercially. Because, as he said, he was playing the sold-out houses every night. And then other bands would come, and they would play to half-filled houses. But because they, quote, had names, they would be paid more than him. He didn't think that was fair. And he started to develop his own business ideas. And he did something in the winter of 1962, which A.B. Spellman refers to as his swan song of the next 3 years. And what happened was Renette rented out Town Hall. It's a big deal. I mean, it's not a small venue. And not in the book, but something Renette told me is that there was a terrible blizzard or some kind of really bad snowstorm, and it really cut down on attendance, and I think he lost his shirt financially. But creatively, he did something really important. And here we go. Here's what it was. He used two supplementary groups in addition to his band for this evening. One a rhythm and blues group, and the other a string quartet. The concert consisted of trio pieces for the Ornette Coleman group. And I don't know who it was in that trio, but you can look it up. Maybe just a drummer and a bass player. And then there was a string quartet. Now, he also had a rhythm and blues band. And I believe his sister sang with that band. And somebody's got to look that up. Ornette Coleman had a sister, and she was a pretty accomplished musician. I mean, she recorded and toured and everything. And I was vaguely aware of that, but, you know, now I'm more aware of it. Anyway, so now we're going to talk about the rhythm and blues. So he had the trio, his trio, then he played off the string quartet. Then he combined with a rhythm and blues group. So I'm going to read, again, we're reading from Four Lives in the Bebop Business, A.B. Spellman. The piece for combined instrumental rhythm and blues group and the Ornette Coleman Trio was considerably more successful, according to Spellman, than what Spellman considered the work with the string quartet, because Ornette played during its entire course and thereby assumed the role of conductor. That piece must stand with Ornette Coleman's record, quote, Free Jazz, as one of the two most important works that he has ever performed. Now, this was written in 1966. So he published in 1966, so he's writing from that perspective. So Spellman obviously couldn't be aware of everything that happened after 1966. But his assessment is that up until that point, Free Jazz and this piece that Ornette performed, trio with rhythm and blues group, was one of the two most important works that he has ever performed. Oh, now we know who the trio is. You're going to find out in a second. So much occurred in the interplay of the strict rhythm and blues beat of the trio and the polyrhythmic playing of Charles Moffett and David Isenzon, that one wonders why all other jazzmen concerned with enlarging their forms did not stop and reevaluate their music. I want to read that again. So much occurred in the interplay of the strict rhythm and blues beat of the trio and the polyrhythmic playing of Charles Moffett and David Isenzon, that one wonders why all other jazzmen concerned with enlarging their forms did not stop and reevaluate their music. Well, I think part of the reason, just as an aside here, is that as far as I know, the record, and I could be wrong, and if I am, please somebody tell me. I haven't done an exhaustive study of this, but I don't think the recording of the rhythm and blues group from that Town Hall concert has ever been released. Now, I'm praying to God that the tapes exist somewhere. I mean, it would be a tragedy if they didn't. And I would love to hear that. And let's see what I can do about getting that to happen, actually, in my spare time. but really, if that if those tapes exist, we've got to hear them, right? Now, here we go. Back to Spellman. Ornette Solo included everything he had learned since his early Texas days. His use of those old rhythm and blues licks was conscious, and it was his concern that this work to solo just high enough above the two groups to include, I don't understand this sentence here. And it was his concern in this work to solo just high enough above the two groups to include the demands of both in his playing. All right. I'm going to read it again. His use of those old rhythm and blues licks was conscious, and it was his concern in this work to solo just high enough above the two groups to include the demands of both in his playing. Okay, so he sort of did a Charles Ives here. He combined a modern jazz trio with a traditional rhythm and blues band, and then he played above that. And spoke to both bands simultaneously. You know, this is Ornette, right? This is Ornette. I mean, that's the epitome of Ornette Coleman right there. I don't know why more people don't compare Ornette to Charles Ives, but that's another story. Going on with Spellman, the piece was embarrassing in its honesty. It was as if Ornette had excavated his entire musical past to get back to the core of his work. There was something intensely autobiographical about this particular piece, which one cannot define but can simply point to. It seemed to include all those things that a man hesitates to say about himself. So we're going to stop there. So maybe it was too personal for Ornette to release. I don't know. I'm hoping that's the case, and I'm hoping those tapes exist, and I'm hoping we can hear them someday, because I think they're maybe one of the most important pieces of American music in the 20th century. So anyway, this all came from Four Lives in the Bebop Business, a spectacularly wonderful and important book by A.B. Spellman, biographies of Cecil Taylor, Ornette Coleman, Herbie Nichols, and Jackie McLean. I only read a tiny fraction, like the smallest, maybe 5%, maybe less, of all the biographical information on Ornette in this book. It's a really, really, really fine book and a very important book. So this started a while back when I met Dave Oliphant and started reading his books about the influence of Texas on jazz. And everybody's sort of vaguely aware of the Texas tenors. But when you start digging deep, you realize that Texas musicians, Texas-born and raised and trained musicians, had a massive, oversized impact on the history of jazz and therefore on the history of American and world music. And Dave and I went into that in great detail in some interviews that we did, and then we did one show just about Ornette and as a Texan, you know, Ornette Coleman, Texan. And then we had a second show where we found some interesting, Dave pointed out to me, and I worked it up, about that gig that Ornette had in Amarillo and the fact that one of the things that he remembers about that gig was jamming after hours with hillbilly musicians. Just, it's a whole different vision of our music, right? Who knew that? You know? Who knew that young Ornette Coleman was jamming with hillbilly musicians and enjoying it? And if you listen to the show, these guys were really good at what they did. And they had their own avant-garde edge. You know, they had a commercial side, and they also had a musical, you know, a personal musical side. And the two met. And you know, you can hear, you know, it, later in his life, Ornette ended up playing with a hillbilly musician named Charlie Hayden. Very sophisticated man, very sophisticated musician, but from that culture. It's very important. These are very important stories, in my opinion. So that was our second program. And then the third program you just heard, we're going really into the depth and the texture of what the musical environment was like in Texas at the time Ornette was coming up. And we're putting out a plea. We're going to start this movement right now to find the tapes of Ornette playing at Town Hall with his trio and the rhythm and blues band, and him holding it all together as they played it. I'm not going to say against each other, but cross each other. It must have been incredible. It must have been incredible. I'd love to hear it. I'm going to see if I can get in touch with DiNardo and see if he's got it. Because I think that'd be a great thing to release at this point. So anyway, this is part three of our series. I think we've covered this topic in great depth. And this, you know, you could follow this up by, of course, listening to Ornette's music and by reading Four Lives in the Bebop Business, this classic, wonderful book written by the late, great A.B. Spellman. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the Internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.